Can everybody hear me if I sit down? I want to feel and actually personify a real digital humanist, so I'm going to sit down. And I want to say thank you to Jason, but also thank you, Emily. Thank you to DigiLab. And I would also like to acknowledge the Center for Teaching and Learning, whose Learning Technologies grant enabled a lot of what I'm going to tell you about. I can't. Since Keith is here, I also can't neglect to thank the Department of Linguistics, especially Chad Howe and Peggy Renwick, who are both here in spirit, and Kyle Vanderneet and Donnie Dunnigan, who are here in body. All right, so my purpose today, as Jason already said, is to tell you about a bunch of text corpora that you can use right now. Here they are. Here's some of them, at least. Points inside this circle represent text corpora that you can use. They are stored on a new machine whose host name is corpus.uga.edu. So if you see a pad of paper going around that says corpus server account, that's what you're signing up for. So sign up if you don't already have an account and if you're interested in using this machine, which stores all of these corpora, not just English, German, Hungarian. Some of the corpora are textual. Those are in blue. And some of them are speech corpora. So that's the actual audio of people uttering those utterances. Those are in orange. So in this talk, which is already too full, I'm just going to be talking about the text corpora, just the blue dots. I'm further going to constrain the scope of the talk to just talking about this subset of the corpora. These are the ones that right now can be searched using a software system called the IMS Open Corpus Workbench, which is I would say fairly industrial strength and can be used for real research in linguistics and I would say right across the digital humanities. My agenda is to give you 10 different examples of how you can use these corpora to do research that I'm hoping is close to what you want to do. I'm not going to do your project for you right now, but I'm going to fire your imagination. You ready to have your imagination fired? Okay, we have to use Unix in order to fire the imagination. But I mean, you'd be doing that anyway, right? Okay. Okay, can everybody, is that big enough? So as Jason said, this corpus searching program that's part of the Open Corpus Workbench is called CQP. And I claimed there are all these corpora in there that you could use now. Here they are. See them? They're in there. You don't have to take notes. You can just and say you don't know what they are. You could ask for info about them. Like, what is Wackypedia? It is 988 million tokens of English from Wikipedia. So if you want to know how English is used in Wikipedia, this might be a good corpus sample for you. Okay. All right. So moving on, I want to work a little bit with a very famous corpus called the British National Corpus. So by typing BNC for British National Corpus, now all the queries that I'm going to do are going to be against that corpus. As a name suggests, as the name suggests, the British National Corpus is British English. And here is some information about what is actually in the British National Corpus. And Emily, here are the dates of what's in there. You can see this is the British National Corpus that came out in 1994. 91% of the material in this corpus is from the late 80s, early 90s. So if you're interested in that awesome time period, this is definitely, and if you're interested in British English, this is definitely the corpus for you. Okay. So let's start off with a lovely example. If you just type a word in single quotes, the CQP query tool will print for you a concordance. And those of you that have studied with Dr. Kretschmar over the years know about concordances. That's where it shows the word that you're searching for surrounded by its collocates, the context that it appears in on either side in the text. Yeah, there's a lot of loveliness in the BNC. Okay, these blue numbers are just positions in the BNC, like which attestation are you looking at? If the concordance is your goal, then you're done. And you can just write that last query that we did to a file like this. And then in a separate window, using the guide to utilizing the UGA corpus server, which Donnie will give you upon request, you will learn to transfer that file back to your computer, and you would have something like this, which you could put in like Microsoft Word or something like that. That would go in your academic paper about lovely in British National Corp. And see, it records what my query was and formats things like lovely young man, lovely gentleman, stuff like that. Okay. So that's just a single word query. One of the great things about the BNC is that it has all kinds of speaker metadata in it. So, you know, if you're like me, you stay up at night wondering who says lovely more? Is it the men or is it the women? So when you wake up, you can find out by entering this query, which leverages, I hope, a piece of metadata. This is an attribute here. Text underscore author underscore sex. This is the whether the person was female or male or unknown who uttered each of those words, each of those lovely attestations that I just heard. Okay. Another piece of metadata that's in the BNC has to do with the modality of the language. Actually, there's cool line editing. Did you know that? Seems like a little more in the written domain than in the spoken domain. So we can actually let me do this. Say we only want to consider attestations of the word lovely, where we know the sex of the person uttering it, and we only want to consider spoken. Okay, we can use a query like this that requires this attribute u underscore sex to be either male or female, and also requires that it be a spoken attestation. Okay, that generates another concordance. Okay, and then we can again ask, is it the men or is it the women? Oops, that didn't work. We should be looking at, sorry, I used the wrong. This is a live demo, you guys. There's an element of danger here, okay? All right, so even when we constrain by spoken, this is still reliably coming out that women are saying lovely more, okay? those of you that have taken Dr. Renwick's quantitative methods class, or are going to, or would like to, will be familiar with this kind of picture. This is a contingency table for attestations of the word lovely, subdivided up by the sex of the speaker, and this is a corpus size that you could get just from reading off the documentation of the BNC. Women in the BNC say lovely at a rate of 105.5 per million, whereas men say it at a rate of 46 per million. Okay, is this due to chance? If you take quantitative methods, you will learn about the log likelihood test and other statistical significance tests that you could use to confirm that, in fact, here, even if you don't have time to take that class, so let me just show you the calculator for it right now. Here, you could just use this handy web page to do your statistical test, and you would find out that indeed women say lovely in the BNC statistically more than men do. All right. So once you've had this initial finding, obviously, I know what you're thinking. You're like, okay, but is it the young women? By the way, you can also name queries with like capital let, like capital W-O-M-E-N. I'm just naming the query. It's another piece of handy metadata. Is it the young women that say lovely? Can I get a, you really don't know? Can you all see the screen?
Nope.
No, it's not the young women that say lovely. That hypothesis has been disconfirmed. It's those in the category 60 plus who say it. Okay, does this make intuitive sense to you guys? Like the sort of British lovely that maybe grandmotherly figure might say? Hey, it doesn't have to accord with your intuition. This is the data, okay? So and what I want to say is that this is the entree to asking a lot of questions about different demographic information that is annotated in a corpus like the BNC, okay? So let's just leave it there. And this is something else. Emily, just for you. There's all these other things that we could be asking about. Are you getting research ideas yet? Occupation, they have codes for social classes in England. Can you believe that? They have it, okay? It's all cross-classified, and you can make queries, get those contingency tables, do the significance test, and write your paper and get published. Okay, let's leave that for now. And move on to those of you that are coming from linguistics, will say, yeah, but what about the linguistic annotations? I mean, I'm interested in linguistic annotations. And the BNC is annotated for that as well. So here are some part of speech tags in the British National Corpus. So you can search for things that are tagged as having a particular grammatical category. I hope everybody can see these, all the verbal tags start with V, and then the second letter of the tag is a capital letter B if you are a form of the copula to B. Does that make sense? Yeah. The coding scheme, it's not that complicated, but it looks kind of strange if you've never seen it before. So these are so-called token level attestations. So you can put them in brackets and that will match an individual token. So for instance, this query is saying, just give me past tense lexical verbs. That's from that table that I just showed you. Do those all look like past tense lexical verbs? Except the ones that are annotation errors. Okay. Just to highlight this, this is here, PAS stands for part of speech. So this is saying it's constraining the tokens to have that particular part of speech. All right. You can put more constraints inside a bracket, but this is just a simple one. You may not, I'm amazed to put it this way. I am amazed to see how much morpho syntax you can actually do with just these part of speech tags. This particular tag set, the clause C5 tag set, is rather fine-grained. And I want to give you some examples of what you can do that maybe you didn't think you could do. At least I didn't think I could do. Okay. So, and these examples, I want to start off by invoking an example from the one of the godfathers of corpus linguistics, Douglas Biber. He defined 67 different linguistic constructions using just part of speech tag patterns. And one of the most interesting, I thought, was a pattern for agentless passives, which we're all told not to use. It's bad, it's hard to understand, but let's find them anyway. This is from his 1988 book. And the core idea of his pattern for agentless passives is that there has to be some form of the copula to be immediately before a verb in its past participle form. So let's do that query. So the first thing has to have some, first token has to be some form of to be. Oops, let's just do. And then the second one has to be not VVD, but VVN. We want a past participle, OK? Now you're taking some time. Maybe is everyone else running these same queries? Is that why I have no CPU cycles available? OK, does that look like we've got a form of B, we've got some kind of past participle that's cropping up, right? As the length of each hit is exactly two words. So some of these are pretty good, but this is a little bit limited. And in fact, what Biber actually specifies is that there can be up to two adverbials in between the form of be and the past participle. So let's improve this query a little bit. I'm going to stick in new stuff in here. And using this neat CQP notation, which says there can be between 0 and 2 matches of this adverbial word in between the form of be and the past participle. Okay. All right, so now we have are adequately supported. We're also seen. Be greatly missed, is very well educated. That's one that you guys are going to use when speaking of each other. Partly funded. I don't want to hear that one. So what did I say we were doing? Agentless passives. So I don't know if you saw, there were some by phrases creeping in there. And if you say, you know, like, was done by John, is that really agentless? No, not at all. We need to fix that. That is wrong. That shall be not tolerated. So what we can do is just use a kind of negative specification, like word must not be by. And let's make sure it's not by in either of its case marked forms, or even its capitalization forms. Sorry, I got case on the brain. OK. All righty. Hopefully you get the idea. Oops. Yeah. Okay. So there we've got different prepositions like asked to, published on, expressed in. We start to get some phrasal verbs in there, okay? We could refine this forever, and I will give you a handout that has like 4 more levels of making this thing more specific. But let's just cut to the punchline and ask for this kind of query, does this appear more in written or spoken? overwhelmingly more in written. This is this sort of turgid style that is so difficult to read that we try to stamp out. Okay, people would never really say this, or at least they'd see it much less frequently in spoken. Okay, so if you have a linguistic construction like agentless passive, you can examine its usage across, what was the title of Fiber's book? Across speech and writing. That's what his book was about. Okay, so let's move on to another interesting construction. Those of you coming from a computer science background may say, sure, this is all cool. These are all just regular expressions, and they could be restated. Very simply. One feature that I think is really cool about CQP is you can have equality constraints. There's equality constraints in the query language, and I want to show that to you. This is a refinement of one of Biber's patterns that is due to Martin Weiser, who I think was that the book, Bill, that you guys used? Did you use his book? No? All right. Well, maybe for another course. Let's run his query, shall we? Okay. Nope. All right. Rather than me recopying all of these things. So here, we're saying, okay, let's look for conjunctions. What do you know if you've ever studied syntax? Conjuncts are supposed to be the same what? Grammatical, help me out here. Category, right? Category, likes conjoined with likes, right? So imagine that you have a word that is, say, a noun, an adjective, an adverb, or whatever, and is definitely not a pronoun, and is separated from another word by the word and, which is tagged as a conjunction. All right, what should the category of the second word, third word be? Should be the same category as the first word. All right, this is something that would be hard to do. I mean, you could do it by enumerating all the combinations, but CQP has this handy syntax for it. Okay, so the point I'm trying to make is that you may have heard that just looking at individual words or patterns or word sequences is not really good enough to look at interesting, say, syntactic phenomena in English. I would say, yes, you can. Yes, you can if you use the part of speech tags intelligently and use features of this query syntax like, So do you get these binomials here like grief and loss, women and children, infection and death? Men and women, nurses and volunteers, okay? You ready to write your master's paper on binomials in English? Yeah, go, get fired up. Okay, all right. You guys are so fired up, we're just gonna have to move on to another example, all right? And this example, oops. Yeah.
Who's that from again?
Martin Weiser. Okay, and this fellow is Patrick Hanks, who was chief editor of English dictionaries at Oxford University Press between 1990 and 2000. And I want to share with you an observation that he made back at the dawn of statistical NLP, way back in 1993, in collaboration with Ken Church, and also Bob Mercer, who is the Bob Mercer that you think it is. Their observation had to do with the words strong and powerful. On the face of it, do those words have a pretty close meaning, strong and powerful? Yeah, I certainly think so. Both are the same grammatical category, adjective. There's a lot to say that's similar about them. But Back in 1993, Ken Church, in trying to explain the utility of natural language corpora to the computational linguistics community, said, hey, look carefully at where strong and powerful occur. In particular, look at the distribution of nouns that they modify. So this is back in 1993. They had corpora of a certain size in that day. But now we have, because I've mounted it for you on this server, we have a New York Times corpus that has 1.3 billion tokens in it. So these queries are going to take a little longer. So let's do a query where we look at the word strong, and we look at the word that is next to it that has part of speech tag nominally marked part of speech tag. And we don't want to be and is also not punctuation because that's no fun. Okay. Oh, that was quick. Okay, so you get a strong sense of where this colloquium is going. You get a strong support for the speaker's suggestion that you get involved in corpus analysis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These are all, you know, appearing. Now let's take a look at powerful. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm on the wrong corpus. That's why it was so quick here. Sorry, this is a claim about newspaper text. Now, all right, that'll take a coffee break. All right, similar results, right? New York Times is written in American English, but similar results. Let's look at powerful. Do another query, capital P, where we look at the same thing. Gurgle, 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 okay. Where is support? The thing that co-occurs with powerful is force. There's a powerful force affecting us. A powerful man, a powerful figure. Okay, this is what people write in the New York Times. Their distribution is manifestly not the same. And we could quantify that, but why bother? I just want to show you that, for instance, one quantification is that the count for supporters as a collocate with strong is 256. The count for supporters with powerful is only 46. So if you're a supporter, you seem to want to go more with strong than with powerful. Okay, that's like a property that this adjective is seeming to have, or some kind of constraint it's exerting on its neighbor. All right, so here's what Patrick Hanks said about this. Hanks, a lexicographer, and it really does say that on his webpage. Like the very first thing is like, I am a lexicographer. Okay, hypothesized that the word strong is an intrinsic quality, whereas powerful is an extrinsic quality. This is a claim about the meaning of these words, okay? Thus, for example, any worthwhile politician or cause can expect strong supporters. Well, we saw that. That's in the newspaper 265 times. Harder to get and more valuable are powerful supporters, okay? So this is an insight into the fine-grained meaning of these two adjectives that you can get by looking at their distribution. And if any of you guys are interested in the philosophy of language, you're interested in the distributional hypothesis due to Firth following Wittgenstein, you can carry out experimental philosophy and test those hypotheses using this tool. This is just the tip of the iceberg, okay? So I've just demonstrated that these two words have different meaning that we can see in detail by looking at their collocates. Okay, let's move on. I appreciate your patience to something a little more literary. I would like to turn now to the work of Michaela Malberg, who studied a certain kind of coordination used in the works of Charles Dickens called the as-if comparison. Luckily, we just happen to have the Dickens corpus. And let's search for two words in the sequence that have to occur consecutively, as if. Okay, so we've got a bunch of Dickens novels loaded up on there. Malberg explains that as if typically introduces a comment by the narrator rather than something that a character is saying. And she identifies several, we did this already. There she is. Michaela Malberg identifies several meaning groups. These are clusters of words that occur as left collocates in as-if comparisons. Okay, we can verify her analysis, and yeah, should we do that? Yeah, let's just do that for a second. Just skip all this complexity. One of the things I think she's keen to study is the role of words about the body that might appear in this position. So we can define a handy list of words that we're interested in. And then we can look for body words this query says, give me words that are from this list of body words that have part of speech that is nominal within 0 to 5 words of as if on the left of as if. So this is like within the range there. And what turns up? You basically get her list, and I did this for all of her meaning groups. And indeed, in our sample as well as hers, the body is a very big deal. And by big deal, I mean 335. That's how big a deal it is. Let's compare that. If we chose 8 random words that are content words, okay, we should expect a number of attestations equal to 8 times the average attestation rate over all those content words, right? If they were truly random, that number would be 18. Instead, we see 335. Can you see where this is going? If you do a log likelihood test and you ask, is 18 different from 335? It is. So this is statistically significant. And I think what I would conclude with Malberg is that it shows that body language is indeed a major Dickensian technique for externalizing characters through narrator comment. All right? I mean, there it is. You know, you may be able to study that a little bit more and like go into more detail on really any of her meaning groups, but this is a kind of confirmation of something that otherwise might have remained just a speculation. Okay, all right. I'm not gonna go into all of those other ones. I actually looked at the residue from her analysis and there isn't much. Her analysis is really tight. Okay, so let's move on to I mean, if you don't like Dickens, how about Shakespeare, all right? So Jonathan Culpepper, who is that guy, suggests that the pattern of pronouns facilitates characterization, facilitates the bard's characterization. Is he talking a bunch of smoke? We can check his analysis. You could check his analysis for yourself. Using the Folger Shakespeare Library, which is also loaded on this corpus server. Okay. Here, this is, Joey, this is for you. This is the null query. So here are the Shakespeare works that are corpora that you can use right now. We might want to find Juliet's, like a character like Juliet. She's in Romeo and Juliet, don't you know? We might want to find her lines and the places where she, this is really hard to do backwards, places where she uses a pronoun. So the Folger Shakespeare Library and some kind folks at Northwestern have annotated these plays using a tagger called Morph Adorner, which I hadn't previously known about. And so their tag set is, of course, idiosyncratic to that tool. But if you know, if you can read the documentation, you can figure out that P is for pronoun, and then N and O, I think, is just like nominative versus accusative or object pronoun. Okay, so okay, there's Juliet using pronouns. If he be married, my grave is, man, I really want to know how that continues. Okay, there's all of her pronoun uses. You could, for instance, spit this out to a file. You could get a count, but I already did that for you. Here's her pronoun distribution. The number is the number of attestations. The middle column is the pronoun, and then these are like, I'm not really sure what that is. So we can know Juliet's pronoun distribution. What would be our reference? What do we want to compare that to? Well, Kyle, are you really here? Nope. Let's ask about contemporary English. Is her pronoun distribution like what we see in contemporary English? Well, we also have, I think a lot of students in our program know about COCA, the Corpus of Contemporary English. That's really flipping huge. Oops, big on syntax errors too. There we go, 531 million tokens. So let's do a search there. Of course, we have to use the tag set that's specific to that corpus. Yep, that's gonna take a bit longer. This is what I mean by industrial strength. Okay, oh, we're done already. If COCA is really representative of contemporary English, then we ought to be able to compare the pronoun distribution in Juliet's lines in Shakespeare to the pronoun distribution in all of contemporary English. And while that's in the oven, let's just skip ahead to the finished product. Oops. Which is, here I have normalized the attestation rate. So this is just like per million words. It's just from, you know, 0 to 1.0. The along the horizontal axis are pronouns that occur in both Juliet's lines and in Coca. Obviously, Coca is going to be a much larger set. So that's the intersection. The blue is the attestation rate in Coca, and the yellow is Juliet's attestation rate. And one of the things that I think jumps out is her use of my and me. You know, everyone talks about themselves and you know, uses I a lot, but she uses my and me more than modern speakers. So what Culpepper says about this, so this basically verifies his analysis. He didn't put a graph in his paper, but you can easily make one with two more Unix commands that you'll learn by the end of finite state linguistics. Culpepper says this is consistent. Her pronoun distribution is consistent with the idea that Juliet spends much of the time in the play bearing her soul, telling people what's on her mind, okay, as opposed to Romeo, who doesn't. We could compute the other corresponding graph, but I'll leave that as an exercise for you guys. Okay, so Culpepper says, although this is not conclusive evidence, it's consistent with the idea that Juliet spends much of the time in the play bearing her soul. All right, so let us now go across the channel. I'm seeing that drowsy eye that says, I want French, okay? We have on this corpus server parliamentary debates from the European Parliament. So europarl.fr is, that's the French version. Did you know that if you get charged with a crime in the EU, you can be arraigned in the language of your choice? Fun fact. Yeah. All right. Okay, so. So anyway, this corpus is morphologically analyzed with a different tagger called tree tagger that was developed by Helmut Schmidt at IMS Stuttgart, and it uses yet another tag set. So hopefully one lesson that you're learning is that these tag sets are not given by God. They're just a convenience that are, you know, made up. So let's look for one of my favorite phenomena. Can we get back to doing what I want to do? Here we go. Let's look for one of my favorite phenomena, verb clusters. So with tree tagger, it will tag infinitive verbs with this VER, and then infi is a kind of a, okay, does this look like French verbs to you? Mm-hmm. Yep. We can use that cool CQP extension to look for longer verb clusters. Like maybe we want three infinitive verbs in a row. A little bit harder to find, but they're there. See that? Bam. Okay. You can make you can see more on either side. There we go. So you can, the neat thing about the Europarl collection is that this is an example of what's called aligned corpora. So, that's not right. That is right. It's just really big. So the Europarl FR is aligned with all these other Europarls because you're allowed to know what your MP is saying in your own language. You have a right to that in the European Union. So if your French is not so good, like mine is not so good, you can just turn on the alignment bead for English and you can see you can see a translation of where it exists. Well, here we go. Yeah, so some of these verb clusters have a quite idiosyncratic meaning. Like here we are in this one, 171, 67, 16. Dire, pouvoir, jouer, you know, say, be able to play. So maybe this is a translation of being able to perform a role, something like that. So imagine that you are actually interested in relationships between languages that are related, like maybe Italian and Spanish, or maybe you're interested in Dutch and German. You would be able to find attestations that were really used in a real legally relevant context, and you would be able to compare them to their corresponding alignment beads. Okay, so let me return. I think I have, at this point, exhausted all the examples that I want to show you.